Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Andy Murray, and you're listening to The Tennis Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph. My name is David Law, a commentator for BT Sport and BBC Radio 5 Live. I'm joined by Catherine Whittaker from Eurosport. Not only tennis these days, but also ice skating she's been doing over the last week. We'll hear more about that later. But Catherine Whittaker, we need to get straight to it because there is a new world number one in town. His name is Andy Murray. How about that?
Or there will be tomorrow, yeah. I mean, technically it's tomorrow, isn't it? Monday, it's one of those weird technicalities, but it's okay to celebrate before the computer actually, or commiserate it for some people, not least Novak Djokovic. I think I'm going to find this podcast quite tough because it's one of those achievements, it's one of those things that's so big and momentous, and I guess because we are British, we have particular experience of Andy Murray. We've probably spoken to him more than any other tennis player. We have sort of special insight, I think, into what it's taken for him to get there. I know it's taken that for every world number one to get there or close to, but we have particular knowledge of that. And I think I'm going to struggle a bit. I probably shouldn't be saying this 1 minute and 40 seconds in. People are tuning out in droves as I speak, but I think I'm going to find it quite difficult actually to really capture in words what this is and what it means, really.
Yeah, so far you've already said that we may as well not be bothering doing this podcast until tomorrow because he's not actually world number one yet, and now you've said that your podcast is going to be rubbish. So great, I'm really thrilled and excited about the prospect. I'm quite happy to carry the load, Catherine. You can just, I tell you what, you just wait till pole vault and then you can get involved in that.
I've got some things to say about that, David. I've been monitoring your activity and I'm like a loaded gun.
Great. Okay.
Just to mark your card.
Looking forward to that already. If you've never listened to the Tennis Podcast before, Pole Vault is where I basically go on Twitter at Tennis Podcast and ask a bunch of questions and get public opinion.
Inane questions to which there is no meaningful or relevant response.
As you can tell, Catherine's can't wait for that section of the show. This is a weekly occurrence. She really, really enjoys it. But what she does is she tries to sort of play that down on a weekly basis.
Don't I do a good job of it?
Don't you? I think one of the strange things about Andy Murray's ascent to world number one is the sheer fact that it didn't involve the match at the end of it. I mean, I don't know about you, but I was at a children's party when I saw on a big screen in a place called Wacky Warehouse. I saw on a TV screen on one of those little sort of scrolling bars at the bottom of a news 24 news hour channel.
How wacky can a warehouse be?
I tell you, this one was particularly wacky, and it was even more wacky when I discovered that Andy Murray was world number one at that particular moment by default. Now, of course, that's not true. He's earned it over the course of a full year. One could say over the course of 12 years, but it was a strange way for it to happen, a quite unsatisfactory way for it to happen on a number of levels. I think he deserved better than that. He deserved a moment of triumph in order to get to world number one. But still, what then struck me is the outpouring, not just from his fans, which you would expect, and probably from the wider British public and so forth, but from his peers, the affection that people seem to have for him and the regard in which he is held. I mean, the number of players up and down the tennis tour, both genders, particularly actually on the WTA side. I mean, I think his attitude towards women's tennis has been really appreciated over the course of the last number of years. But I think, yeah, I mean, he's not a song and dance man, is he, Andy Murray? But there's an appreciation that this is a decent guy who's worked his butt off for so long and has had these three roadblocks in the way, three of the, if not the greatest players of all time in the way, and that it might never have happened. And here it was. It did happen.
Yeah, he's muscled his way in to what I consider the greatest era of men's tennis in terms of there being three, now four, incredibly great players all playing pretty much their best at the same time at some point or another over the last 10 years. I mean, the fact that he's the oldest new number one since John Newcombe in 1974, that tells you what a struggle has been. That tells you that it really has been 12 years in the making, or 11 years since he officially turned pro, I think. That's what it's taken. He has been clawing and clawing for every one of those days, months, years. You know, I picture him on that Versa climber. I feel exhausted just thinking about the Versa climber, which is his preferred method of torturing himself in training. I think preferred is probably not quite the right way of putting it. I remember Kyle Edmund talking earlier this year about how much of a shock to the system it was doing a training block with Murray in Dubai and being introduced to the Versa climber. He said he considered himself quite a fit guy until that moment. I just have this sort of image of him, this metaphorical image of him on the Versa climber, trying to climb up to that number one spot. And just no matter how hard he climbs, there's somebody there climbing a bit faster or whatever it is, you know. It's just amazing. I've got to that point where I need to try and sum it up, and I can't really, other than to say that I'm really pleased, as you point out, that others seem to appreciate what an achievement it is. I have been very heartened by the response, because people do seem to get it. It really, really is momentous, more momentous than a Wimbledon title, more momentous than an Olympic gold medal. And all of those things are momentous. For me, this is the most momentous in terms of Andy Murray.
The only aggro that I encountered upon hearing this news from anybody out there was actually people from golf who were saying, I don't seem to recall all this fuss when Lee Westwood or Luke Donald got to world number one. But I mean, for me, there's a couple of things there. One is they never won a major title, and I think that is an asterisk. We've talked about it in terms of Caroline Wozniacki, Eleni Jankovic, Dinara Safina, Marcela Rios. I do feel that it is difficult to look at them in exactly the same way if they don't win a major title. Plus, from a British perspective, those two golfers were number three and four respectively over the course of two or three decades who got to world number one. No British player has ever done it before. And to do it within this era only adds to that level of achievement. Now, I do feel that there are people that could say, well, hold on, he hasn't done it when those three players have been present and at their best, because Djokovic has gone through a few months of struggle. Nadal, we know, has had the wrist injury and hasn't been at the level he was a few years ago, and Federer has been injured for 6 months. Is there anything there that would make you want to say or accept that there is a question mark over whether actually would he have done it if those people were in place and playing well?
Well, what do you mean? I mean, what if Rod Laver was still at his peak, he'd be a challenge as well. I'm not really sure.
No, now you're being silly because Roger Federer's been injured for six months.
But I'm not sure saying, oh, he's not had to play Nadal. I mean, for me, Nadal is not in the equation anymore. He might be again in the future. I don't see any signs of it just now. But to say, oh, well, he's not played Nadal in that period, irrelevant, I'm afraid. The only thing I would give any credence to in what you just said is not having played Djokovic. It's just one of those quirks of draws and schedules that they haven't actually met in the last 6 months, not met since the Paris final. I want to see that match. I want to see if it brings the Djokovic of the first half of 2016 out in Djokovic, and I want to see if it brings out the baggage that he had been walking onto court with against Novak Djokovic. If becoming world number one sort of erases some of that baggage, I want to see that match up with the new rankings dynamic. I really do, and I feel pretty sure I've said it on the podcast before. I think Murray wants to play that match as well. I really do. I think he would like to prove himself in that matchup. And I do think there would be so much going on there psychologically. I want it to happen at the O2. I really do.
They did have that little crossover point, didn't they? When Murray was starting to get towards this sort of form in beating Djokovic in Rome and then losing to him in four sets in that French Open final. They had that little moment of crossover there. They haven't played since. And frankly, Djokovic hasn't really been the same player since either. I wonder whether they ever will. You know, I mean, how serious is this for Djokovic? That's what I'm trying to work out.
You're wondering if they'll ever play again?
No. Well, I think they'll play again, but will we see them at their best at the same time? I mean, how serious is this this slide from Djokovic? Is it a blip? I just don't think we don't know. It will be interesting to see what state Novak Djokovic turns up at the O2, because from what I saw and from what I've heard of him in the press conference, He doesn't sound that bothered about it all at the moment. It sounds as though he's struggling to find reason to really care that much. I mean, where do you get motivation from? It sounds quite serious to me.
Yeah, I think so too. It's a real shame. I'm not enjoying watching it. As I say, you know, it feels like we're seeing somebody unravel a little bit before our eyes. I do think he will get back on track. I'm not sure we'll ever see him have a 2-year period of utter dominance the way we have in the last couple of years. I'm not sure we'll see that again. He will win Grand Slams again, surely. I really can't quite envisage a world just yet where he doesn't. But it perhaps is a bit more serious than I originally thought. I mean, he quite clearly is burnt out and needs some time away from tennis. And I had thought perhaps if it weren't for the fact that Murray were clipping at his heels on the rankings front, he might have done a Nadal and decided to sit out the rest of the season. Now, Murray's already caught him. I know that Djokovic can catch him back up if he has an amazing time at the O2, but you're right. Even now, he doesn't seem to be massively motivated in the immediate term to get that number one ranking back. And if that's not a motivator, you probably just need to step away. And I don't know. I don't know Novak Djokovic. I don't know what'll work for him. But he's not suddenly not a good tennis player. That's the only fact we have.
You know when you say surely he'll win more Grand Slam tournaments, I mean, that logic suggests yes, that's true. But I do feel, when I think of someone like Bjorn Borg and to a lesser extent John McEnroe, those are two players that did it all and kind of hit the wall just hit the wall. And even though McEnroe came back, and obviously Bjork tried to make comebacks, they could never dig into that well again. I feel as though, I mean, Borg left it probably too long, but I can kind of relate to it. The amount of stress, the amount of mental effort that it took for Djokovic to do what he's done, it seems to me to have resulted in him almost not wanting to have to put himself through that anymore, and that you know, he could probably do without it a bit. And unless he, you know that feeling sometimes when you see both him and Murray on the court and something happens and you see that defiance come out, that sort of, right then, okay, I'm going to show everybody here. That's gone at the moment from Djokovic. He needs to get that look back, that look of, I'm going to just make sure that I win. I don't care what it does to me. I'm going to win.
Yeah.
And he's lost that.
Yeah, and I do just wonder if a match with Andy Murray, who's just taken his crown from him, could be the thing to bring that out in him. I'm going to show that, well, not that you're not the rightful number one. I believe his magnanimity on that front. But, you know, I'm going to show that I'm still a force here. You might have got the number one ranking for now, but I'm still there and I intend to get it back. I do wonder if it's that matchup that could, even if only fleetingly for the duration of that match, if he's unable to muster it in that situation, then I would really, really think, wow, he needs to step away and reset somehow. He needs the reset button, doesn't he? He needs to power down and power up again. That fixes all problems, doesn't it? Off and on again.
It certainly does. Certainly when my computer blows up. We talked about burnout a few weeks ago. I think he needs a long break, and he needs to. And that may even be. I mean, look, I think he'll play the O2, but there's a bit of me that wonders whether he could just do it getting away from all of it, and having 2 months away. But anyway, we'll see what happens. Just on going back to Murray more generally, four tournament wins in a row. Do you feel that could you put your finger on a point where you thought, actually, this is different now? This guy is relentless, and unless Djokovic can stay with him, he's going to get to world number one. Is there a point that you could identify?
If I had to create a point in my mind, it perhaps wasn't as, you know, light bulb as what you're describing. But the moment I heard he was boarding a private jet from Rio to Cincinnati to play there, I thought, okay, he means business now. I thought, crikey, that is the behaviour of somebody hell bent on getting to the top. I couldn't really think of another reason for him to play Cincinnati. We talked about it at the time on that podcast, which brings me to another point that it's worth mentioning. He got no ranking points for that Olympic win, no ranking points. So in real terms, if you factor in that Olympic win, he's actually got there by more of a margin, really, than the computer will tell you at the moment.
Yeah, no, that's true. I would actually go back to the reemployment of Lendl, and it's not necessarily in inverted commas the Lendl factor as much as the intent behind it, and knowing the kind of character that Lendl is and the kind of character that got him to world number one and stayed at number one and had that relentlessness. I think that Lendl and Murray ran out of goals a little bit 2 or 3 years ago when they went their separate ways, and they'd climbed the mountain, and it was like, right, what now? You know, I do feel that Murray struggled for motivation himself for a while, and over the last couple of years, having come back from back surgery, having done well, but having still been in the slipstream and the shadow of Novak Djokovic, I think that coupling once more just made made sense to the two of them that actually we do have a goal here. We do have something you know, Andy Murray has never done before, and it is achievable. There's something about Lendl's approach, that relentlessness that Andy Murray lacked before. He was brilliant, he was strong, he was defiant, but he was in and out. And he wasn't able to do it without a cause. Lendl has that ability, even though he's not even been around that much, just his whole philosophy is about, right, do it again, right, do it again. And you've seen that over the last few months.
Yeah, I'm not sure anybody can argue with that, because the results tell the story, don't they? I mean, there has been an enormous uplift in his performance, his drive, his results since he re-employed Lendl. So, that is fact. And
with a guy like Delgado, who seems to be able to just provide the environment and the atmosphere in which he can, and the framework for him to just keep doing that. I mean, he's been the ever present, hasn't he? I knew Jamie quite well when he was a player. I don't know him as a coach. I don't know really what he does, but he obviously does something very, very right.
No, I feel exactly the same. I've had a couple of tweets saying, oh, you know, make sure you give Delgado the credit he deserves in this week's pod for getting him to number one. And I thought, yes, you're right, but I don't really know what to say, because I feel the same as you. I don't know specifically what the nitty-gritty of his role in that team is, particularly when Lendl is there. What I do know is that we know Andy Murray needs stability. He needs somebody with him that's going to be there week in, week out when he is on the road, that's going to be a constant presence. It's a very, very challenging life being on the road. And I'm not saying he's just, you know, a buddy to eat with and all the rest of it, but I think that element is important to him. He needs the stability and the consistency. And, you know, Lendl's never going to sign up to 38 weeks a year. And Delgado has done that. And again, the results don't lie. It works.
And I think that that's probably something he lacked throughout the period of time that he was with Emily Maresma. I think that they needed to have that second person. They tried it with Jonas Bjorkman. It went relatively well. But I think that that's ultimately something that he really lacked in that period, was that ever-present. I'm trying to work out, I mean, it's only speculations. All we can do is speculate, is work out whether, or give our views on whether we think that there will be now a Murray era. The fact that we've had Federer, and it's unlikely that he's going to be able to regularly compete at that level again, I would have thought at least. Nadal, he spoke in a Times interview a couple of days ago about how he's desperate to challenge for slam titles again. The unknown with Djokovic. Could you see Andy Murray taking this on now and actually this time next year, for instance, still being world number one?
Of course I can. Of course that's a strong possibility. Anybody who says it isn't is wrong. It's also a strong possibility still for me that Djokovic comes back strong and this blip seems nothing more than a blip, and, you know, he goes on and wins the Australian Open the way he summarily does. It's also a strong possibility that, you know, someone like Zverev suddenly takes a step up, which frankly he's taking sizable steps up all the time, but, you know, comes from nowhere and wins a Grand Slam title. You know, that's not, all of these things are possible. So yes, I think it's very possible that Murray could do that, but I just don't know. After the Australian Open, after the French Open, everyone thought Djokovic is going to win everything for the next year and a half, because he's just won everything for the year and a half. Well, it doesn't work like that, does it? Just because it seems that way now, you know, people have short memories in sport. I'm guilty of it as much as anybody, but and I know it's not very satisfying on a tennis podcast to hear the experts say, I don't know, but we don't.
Well, the beauty is, of course, we've got pole vault to look forward to, which is when we discuss all this, and we actually have your listener opinion as well. And of course, Catherine, we've also had a tweet today from Sam, who says, personally, I'd like to hear Rosie's thoughts on Andy getting to number one. What does Rosie think of all this?
Well, I like Sam, for starters. Well done, Sam. I mean, if Rosie were here, I feel confident speaking for Rosie that she would not approve of what's coming up in pole vault and would express her view accordingly.
Fine. Okay. Well, Rosie, you know, I'm glad you're not here then, really. Rosie's a dog, by the way, if you haven't listened to the last 6 weeks of the tennis podcast. Other storylines from Paris, the man that Andy Murray beat in the final, John Isner, that was a good journey to the final for him, wasn't it? Because it's felt a bit like he's been treading water to me over the last 2 or 3 years, and that will be much needed. Maybe he can mount a bit of a spurt next year. There is opportunity out there for players like him and Marin Cilic and other big hitters who've just been in the slipstream of these guys.
Yeah, I mean, the career of John Isner has been a bit of a mystery to me, really. I mean, I know, given his height, there are obvious huge advantages and obvious major limitations. He could never be a world number one or a, you know, multiple Grand Slam champion. But, you know, he should have got to a big collection of Grand Slam quarterfinals and probably a couple of semifinals and, you know, reached more semis and finals of Masters, I reckon. I know that makes it sound really easy, and there's been people like Djokovic and Murray and Federer and Nadal around making sure that nobody really has a chance at that. But I've wondered about his desire. I've wondered about, you know, whether he is one of those players, and we know they exist, and it's another sort of each to their own point, that it is just happy to be a sort of top 20, top 30 player to make sure they're seeded at the Slams and get into the Masters Series and do relatively well and live a nice life and can be pretty happy with what they do. But, you know, don't put in the hours on the Versa Climber that Andy Murray does. I don't know. I genuinely don't have anything specific to back up that hypothesis, other than that his results generally should have been better, I think. So it's not a surprise for me to see him playing some really good tennis and having some good results. It's more a surprise that he hasn't done it more frequently over the last 8 years.
Yeah, I'm surprised that we haven't seen more of John Isner, particularly at the Slams in the latter stages, given his weapons. I think he hasn't always scheduled his year that well. Personally, I think he's got some things wrong there. But look, you know, he's still a huge guy. He's still got an incredible weapon with that serve, and maybe his best is still to come. Now, the O2 starts in just a week's time, Catherine. I think the actual draw is tomorrow, Monday.
Marin Cilic, the players are Skyping in.
Are they? Oh, crikey.
Yeah.
Skyping in, how's that work?
Well, I think they, and I think this is a good decision, they wanted to do the draw earlier this year than they have done in previous years, so that people buying tickets in the remaining week before it starts can know what they're going to see. And I think there's something to be said for that.
And actually, I suspect that the organisation of the tournament probably needs that more this year than it ever has before because of the absence of Nadal and Federer.
Yes, I would have thought so. It's a fantastic tournament, but how can they not have been hit up until this point by their absence? I mean, of course, Andy Murray, having the profile that he has, achieving what he has just done, will help. And I think this will help as well. I think it's a really good call from them. It means they don't get that fantastic picture to accompany the draw, but I think it's quite cool them getting the players to Skype in.
Yeah, it is quite cool. I'll have to figure out how to do it, how to follow this, Catherine. You'll have to tell me how it all works. Anyway, the draw will come up. I mean, if it's anything like the WTA finals, it may end up leading, I suspect, to better matches with one or two major stars, but then people like Gael Monfils, Dominic Thiem. Cilic has been there before, but he didn't do well. He was injured. Milos Raonic, I suppose there's a big question mark over him right now with the tear in the quad that he suffered and that put him out of that semi-final in Paris.
Yeah, I mean, on paper, it looks great. On paper, it's a lineup I'm really excited about, genuinely. But whilst obviously sad about the absence of Federer and Nadal. However, I would say there's a question mark more than just over Milos Raonic. There's a question mark over Gael Monfils still for me. There's a question mark over Dominic Thiem. I won't bore you all with it again, but oh, Dominic, come on.
Isn't the reason he's made it that he's played all these events?
What? David, he pulled out of the US Open, basically exhausted during his, what was it, fourth round match against Del Potro. I mean, reaching Grand Slam semi-finals will get you there as well as playing three ATP 250 events on the bounce. I know which I'd rather do. Anyway, I'm really pleased he's there, really. I'm not laying into Dominic Thiem. I think he's great, and that's where this comes from. I'm really pleased he's qualified, but he shouldn't have been in a position where he lost second round in Vienna and first round in Paris and was having to sit and wait and see if others overtook him. He just shouldn't have been in that position. But anyway, yeah, on paper, it's a really exciting lineup. I genuinely like it. I like that there's some new blood in there. I love that Gael Monfils has qualified. I love that. But it does seem a bit of a limp across the finish line. I mean, even Andy Murray has a question mark. I mean, he must be running on fumes. He must be. Surely.
Yeah. Incidentally, I do agree with you on Dominic Thiem. I think there is a point to be made that part of the points accumulation comes from players playing a lot of events sometimes. But to me, his gifts are such that he should be copying what the very top players are doing, scheduling wise, because he's capable. He's that good. He's Stan Wawrinka like. And we will see what his future brings. But yeah, I'm excited by the O2 lineup. But inevitably, it is so often compromised a little bit the end of season tournament on both sides just by the sheer miles on the clock that these players have got. So we'll see what they turn up like. I mean, do you remember one or two of the first years that the tournament took place, Djokovic really struggled with that. And then eventually his scheduling was so good that he came into the tournament with more energy than anybody. So that's a learning process as much as anything, I suspect. Now, Catherine, pole vault. Are you excited?
Come on then. Give me your best shot.
You actually had a public go at me, I saw, on Twitter.
I did. I snapped, David.
I mean, I was quite hurt, actually.
I thought you could take it because West Brom had just beaten Leicester. I thought, now's my time.
Yeah, well.
Sorry, could you repeat that?
What was that?
That was Google voice recognition. As I said, West Brom beat Leicester. It did a Google search for me. I now have search results, David, all about West Brom's glory today. It's not what I wanted, but...
And it asked you to repeat that.
Yeah.
Doesn't it understand who West Bromwich Albion are?
No, it said, sorry, I didn't understand what you're saying. I'm sure if I'd said Man United or Arsenal, she wouldn't have said that anyway.
Tell you what, take a hammer to that computer is what I would say. Anyway,
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Pole vault. We have a number of fascinating topics today, folks. You'll be delighted to know. First of all, we have this time next year, I asked you, Catherine, so I won't ask you again. This time next year, where will Andy Murray be ranked? Number one, number two, 3 to 5, or 6 to 10?
Was there a, I don't know, because no, nobody
knows. No, there isn't that. No.
Right, okay.
Sorry. Yeah. 53% think you'll be number one in the world. 40% think you'll be number two. So that's 93% think you'll either be number one or two in the world next year. And in fact, Isaac says, barring injury, it's unthinkable that he will be below at least number two. Which, you know, I can see where he's coming from. I mean, I would also say there is that question mark about motivation. We just have no idea how climbing the peak for Andy Murray will affect him. He's never done it before.
No, it's probable. It isn't certainly not unthinkable. The alternative is not unthinkable, though. Isaac, I'm thinking it now. It's happening. It's thinkable.
Okay. Catherine Whittaker here on the Tennis Podcast. Number two pole vault for this week. In 2017, Andy Murray will win the Australian Open, the French Open, both or neither.
Again, was there an I don't know? No, there was no I don't know because we all, everybody knows. Yeah.
What's the point of a tennis podcast if you don't know anything?
Sorry, David. I momentarily forgot your Mystic Meg-like powers. Forgive me. Go on then. What we got?
We've got 56% reckon that he will win the Australian Open. 7%.
Yeah, he's the favourite to win the Australian Open. Of course he is. He's the world number one.
No, how can he be the favourite to win the Australian Open when Djokovic has won it 86 times?
Because he's the best player in the world right now. Are you saying he's not the favourite to be the world number one, to win the Australian Open? Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah, I am. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think he's the favourite to win the Australian Open right now. No. I mean, he's the best player in the world. However, the Australian Open has certain characteristics, as does the French Open. I'd say it's about 50-50.
I think you're being argumentative, David.
I'm not, when have I ever been argument? Anyway, so 56% reckon that he'll win the Australian Open, 7% think he'll win the French Open, 20% think he'll win both. How about that? And 17% reckon that he'll win neither of them. So there you are, Catherine. As you can tell by the silence, folks, Catherine is just open-mouthed at the moment with excitement of pole vaults here on the Tennis Podcast. At what point is number three? At what point should Andy Murray become Sir Andy Murray?
This is the one that you've got to prepare yourself for me to unleash now.
Go on, give it to me.
Okay, I mean, it's a multi-pronged unleashing. Okay?
Okay,
and
I'm ready.
I should probably preface it with I personally don't have any Republican issue with knighthoods and honours. It's not coming from that place. I think there's a separate argument to be had. I'm sure Dave Levy will have it with anyone
our
on Twitter who wishes
friend
to...
Friend of the tennis podcast, who, Dave Levy.
Yes, who wishes to have that debate, and that's fine. That's a separate debate, though. My points aren't on that basis. I think honours are, in principle, fine. But my first point here is, who cares? He's just become the world number one, okay? A knighthood is a recognition of achievements that have already been achieved. Well, we're all recognising how great the achievement is. What does a knighthood matter? What does it matter? Number two, let the bloke enjoy it, for goodness sake. I mean, what? Just let him enjoy being world number one. That is enough.
pole vault
doesn't
work like that.
He's achieved something incredible. That's enough in itself. What, number three, I genuinely don't think he wants it or it's appropriate for him to have it during his career. I find the prospect of him being introduced onto the centre court at Wimbledon as Sir Andy Murray preposterous, frankly, and I think he would feel the same. Number four, he will definitely get one at some stage, so there's no debate to be had. Of course he's going to get one. I mean, they give them out like candy on Halloween. Of course he's going to get one. He's our greatest sportsman of all time, and I know that's debatable. Somebody,
oh yeah, that's a good debate.
Others would think differently, but I'm not sure anybody could argue that he's not one of our greatest sports people of all time. He is one of. He will get a knighthood. Getting it now is preposterous. Talking about it now, also preposterous.
What about pole vaulting it?
Well, I know that's already happened, so there's no point in me protesting.
Right, so so what's your answer then, Catherine? At what point should Andy Murray become Sir Andy Murray? 46% say now, 4% say if he does the career slam, 43% say when he retires, and 7% say never. Which one are you going with?
When he retires.
Catherine Whittaker, here on the Tennis Podcast. Oh, that's got to be an absolute record-breaking enthusiasm. Pole vault number four, this time next year, Catherine Whittaker will be a fully-fledged pole vault convert. genuine poll. 28%
this was voted
say
on,
yes.
This was voted on, though, before people heard this recording.
And yeah, well, 63% say
in
no.
My tone of voice.
You'll be pleased to know, Catherine, in this particular pole vault, there is a don't know as well.
Hooray!
9% don't
Although,
know.
Ironically, this is the pole vault that is most unequivocal and least requires a don't know option. But anyway.
Fine. Okay. Well, Catherine hates pole vault. Sorry, everybody. I mean, you knew that already, but what can I do? I mean, it's...
Occasionally, there's one that I think is worthy. I just think, generally... Anyway, what are the answers? What have people got?
28% say that yes, you will be a fully fledged pole vault convert if David Law has anything to do with it. 63% say no, you won't, and 9% don't know. And frankly, I'm just giving up. you've just broken me down after that rant.
Sorry.
God, dear.
I did.
So
you were given ample warning.
I was so looking forward to this show. Now,
That's why I warned you. That's why I warned
you. Anyway, let's just finish with I knew Andy Murray would be world number one when... And we got some lovely contributions here. Ahmed says, when he won the Davis Cup and welcomed Sophia Olivia into the world. These things always seem to catapult players to number one and reinvigorate them. Mike Tomlinson... so says Ahmed. Mike Tomlinson, who is an advocate of consumer rights, a former employee in retail banking, and a huge tennis fan and a horror film fan, says...
How do you know that about him?
Because I've just read his profile on Twitter. All
is
right,
that what
Mike?
We're doing now?
Well, that is what we've just done. Mike Tomlinson
I felt like
says...
you just read his online dating bio. Crikey. Hello, Mike.
Oh, well, this has taken an unexpected turn. Mike Tomlinson says when he was struggling in long matches in 2006 and 2007 and then next year had turned into an athletic machine, that showed he was serious. Yeah, I think that was part of that was one of the building blocks, definitely, wasn't it, for him to get from where he was as a junior to where he is now.
The bicep kiss, I think, is the moment.
That was good. Yeah. I particularly enjoyed the bicep kiss, followed by the cutaway into the crowd where Will Ferrell was there, the comedian, the comic actor. Will Ferrell.
No, it's Will Ferrell.
Oh, fine, whatever.
You're thinking of Ferrell, the hip-hop producer come singer, David. You're
surprising.
Mixing your Ferrells.
Given my music collection, hardly surprising. That's how up with it I am. Craig says, when he massively improved on clay the past few years after his back surgery. Yeah, I'd say that's another good one, Craig.
Yeah, yeah.
Adele says,
The Adele,
I reckon, yeah. The one
Why
who sang
not?
That
We've
that
no
song,
evidence to the contrary, so let's assume it is The Adele.
Yeah. All I can say is hello.
Oh, God.
When I honestly didn't. Adele says.
We didn't rehearse that bit. We didn't. I promise. David is just that witty.
Yeah. Adele says, I honestly didn't think he would. I thought he'd be the best world number two in decades, but remained that way.
Well, good on her for being honest about that, because I think there's a lot of people that felt that way that are probably now saying, oh, yeah, I always knew he'd get to world number one.
Actually, that is a good question. Honestly, what did you think? If you were to go back, I don't know, to when he won Wimbledon for the first time, to when he won Wimbledon this year, I mean, I'm sure we've documented it in the 259 previous episodes. I'm sure somebody can catch us out. But I would definitely say there was a big question mark in my mind as to whether he would ever be world number one, simply because of how different it is winning the Slam. Look at Wawrinka. He's never gotten close to world number one, and yet he's won three slams. And Andy Murray said that in his press conference, didn't he, last night, about how it's his best achievement because it's harder. It's harder to do this. But he has added, that's why I made that big point about Lendl, and I don't even know if it is Lendl's impact, but a relentlessness has come over Andy Murray in his approach to the sport in the last 6 or 8 months. You're not seeing that dodgy couple of tournaments just thrown into the mix. I mean, the last ones you'd have to go back to really are Miami and Indian Wells. And I'm really interested to see next year whether he just basically charges his way through those draws as well. I mean, there is a tangible difference.
That will be very interesting because, of course, he hadn't been thinking in terms of getting to number one this year. He was seeing that period, the sort of Dubai, Indian Wells, Miami period, as his window to get to number one. So he was headlong thinking of throwing himself into that period and not having a blip there like he has done before. I think it's something is clicked. He's clicked into the mindset of this is how he does things now. He's already 29, so it's not like he has to think he's got 10 years ahead of him of doing this. I think that must help mentally. But yeah, I mean, I certainly wouldn't have said a year ago with any great. I would have said, I think he has a chance to. I wouldn't write him off from doing it by any means. I wouldn't have confidently predicted that he would have got to number one this time last year. I really, at any stage, have got to number one at any stage. I think to go back now and say, oh, yeah, I always knew. I'm sure some people did. I'm sure some people would have said it with confidence and well done them. But I wouldn't have been one of those people.
So there you go, Adele. We're impressed with you, and you brought out our honesty intern, and we both admitted that we were rubbish. Karina says, "I knew that he would get to world number one when he threw up on the court at the U.S. Open and still beat Andre Pavlin 5 sets."
Yeah,
great memory.
Not a bad shout. Not a bad shout. I'm just reading a piece on the Telegraph, which reports.
Shouldn't you be concentrating on the tennis podcast?
Well, no, I had it up, but I've just read the headline, and it reports Annabelle Croft's view, which I really agree with, and it's something that I hadn't thought about for a while. I've recalled it many times on the tennis podcast, but she dates it back to that scrappy win over Benoit Paire in Monte Carlo in April. And it was a turning point. It was. And I'll quote it again. He came into that press conference and he said, in the most steely way that I've seen him say most things, that was a really big win for me. There was something in his eyes. There was a reason why I kept on banging on about it for ages afterwards. He knew it was almost like something had clicked. It really was. It was a big turnaround. He was match point down. He really should have lost that match. He was not playing well. Went on to lose to Nadal in the semi-finals, then final in Madrid, won Rome, final, you know. We know what's happened since then, but it really was like something clicked for him in that match. And I think Annabelle might be onto something there.
And I seem to remember whether it was that one or whether it was one of those come from behind wins at the French Open, because he was really in trouble, wasn't he, in the first couple of rounds of the French Open this year. And I remember the quotes were, that could end up being one of my most important wins, you know? Even though it was on paper, what are you doing against him?
Yeah.
I think it might have been the one against Stepanek.
Yeah, it was.
And he ended up getting to the final, didn't he? And I think there's that. I also feel that at some point maybe a player can have a performance like that and get away with it and think, I am not doing that again. I am not going to – I think sometimes a player can maybe even be a little immature on court and think, that's not acceptable. I need to be better than that. I don't know whether Andy Murray felt that, but yeah, anyway, all great little marks in the sand, aren't they, over the course of his career, and what a career it's been. And it's ended up with him as the world number one for 1 week, 2 weeks, or however long until he might get knocked off and maybe he'll never do it again. We've seen players in the past only get there for 1 or 2 weeks in their careers. But
he could do a Kafelnikov from this point on.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I was thinking back to Reigns as world number one, and they're all valid. All these people who were world number one, even Rios, who I've made the point didn't win a slam, he still got to number one of the world. Huge credit to him for that. But, you know, Yevgeny Kafelnikov, it was quite unfortunate that he ended up as world number one on the back of 6 first round losses in a row. Extraordinary. I remember being there at the tournament in Prague when he went to world number one after 6 first round losses in a row.
And
just
then,
the way the rankings worked out.
And then suffered another few first round losses subsequently, no? Didn't he lose several consecutive matches after becoming world number
one?
Maybe
it was that way around, but he certainly lost 6 in a row. And it was just obviously the points he'd accumulated over the course of the 12 months to that point got him there. And then it didn't look great, but the fact is he was world number one. And when you look at, I mean, what's Andy Murray, one of 26 people in history, men, that have ever got to world number one, you can never take that away. It's a fantastic moment for him. I think it's a great moment for tennis, to be quite honest, because I think that the Big Four, as they've been coined over the years, it would have been a heck of a shame if they had not all been world number one. I think there would have always been that question mark over whether you can use that terminology to describe them. Well, I think you can now, even though Murray's 7 or 8 slams behind even Djokovic, let alone the others. I think he will close that gap a bit. I think he might double the amount he's got right now, don't you?
You think he'll win another 3 minimum?
I think he'll win another 3. Yeah, I do. I don't know whether he'll win any more than that, but I could see him winning another 3.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, I think that's probable. Yeah, I think 3 is probable. Once you start getting into 4, it's injury, all of, you know, beyond that, I wouldn't want to do any predicting.
And equally, as we've said, you know, it is very easy sometimes to look at the current, the status quo, and think, oh, you know, this will just carry on the way it is. Mm. And things can change. But
things
here and now,
happen, David. Things happen.
Things happen. And who knows, maybe next week there won't be a pole vault. Well, that ain't happening. I promise you there will be one. Catherine will be there, ringside.
Next week I'll have plunged into such pole vault-induced despair that I'll have done a U-turn and employed a spiritual guide.
Well, actually,
what are the chances of that, do you reckon?
From what I'm hearing, you'll have started your own figure skating podcast by then.
Yeah. There's a gap in the market, David. Gap in the market.
I've already looked it up on Twitter. There is no at figure skating podcast handle.
I could become a podcast, sports podcast empresario.
Yeah.
That would be something, wouldn't it?
Off you go then, go and do that. You know, already deserted tennis once this week. If you didn't know, Catherine has been commentating alongside Simon Reid, a very, very good commentator we've had as a guest here on the Tennis Podcast in the past. And they've been talking about ice skating. And very well they did too, I have to say. I didn't really understand too much of it. I watched at least 2 hours, really enjoyed it, didn't understand a word, but sounded like you knew what you were talking about to me.
Oh, bless you, Dave. You made me feel bad for being mean to you now.
So you should feel bad. So you should, because I am hurt. And all pole vault fans around the world listening to the Tennis Podcast right now are equally hurt, and hoping, Catherine, that you will be the person that 28% of the voters have said you will be a year from now, a fully fledged pole vault convert. But anyway,
I look forward to letting down 28% of our listenership.
Indeed. As we tend to do on a regular basis, at least that number. Very nice talking to you, Catherine. Have a good week.
He said through gritted teeth.
Very gritted teeth. We will be back. I don't exactly know when. I mean, we've got to come back, I guess, before the O2 starts, Catherine, which is next Sunday. So we'll see if we can get a preview show going for that, or at least over the weekend. Lovely to talk to you, all of you. Thanks for listening. Do leave us a review on iTunes if you haven't already. Follow us on Twitter at Tennis Podcast. Get involved in all the talking points that I just dream up in the middle of the night. And we'll speak to you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.